It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. It's coming up, we'll talk to a defense reporter about the tentative deal Congress has reached to reform veterans' health care in the United States.
First, a new report out takes a look at the well-being of children in Wisconsin and across the nation.
The report came out last week. It's an annual report, and 2014 marks its 25th anniversary. It gives researchers the opportunity to look at how far we've come, what could still use improvement. They found that in the last 25 years, Wisconsin kids have made strides in areas like health and education, but are worse off economically.
Joining us now in the studio to talk about the report and its implications is Ken Taylor, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So Wisconsin currently ranks 13th among the states in child well-being. How exactly did that figure get arrived at, that ranking?
Well, that ranking comes from a combination of 16 different data points that the Annie E. Casey Foundation puts together and has been putting together, as you said, for 25 years. And so we look at information in four different categories: in economic well-being, in education, in health, and in family and community, and combine them together to come up with the ranking, which, as you said, is 13th this year.
And how has Wisconsin changed over time? Where were we last year?
Well, this is one step down from last year. We were ranked 12th last year. But for me, the individual ranking, whether it's 12th or 13th, is less important than what tier we're in. So if we're ranked 13th or 12th, we're still in the top tier compared to other states that are in the bottom tier. That said, we are in the bottom of the top tier, and we have neighbors who have higher well-being scores than we do, and so we know that we have some distance to travel.
Well, there's a lot of good news there, still in the top tier there. But let's start with that. What is Wisconsin doing right?
Well, one of the things that we've done right historically is that we've made pretty substantial investments in our kids. So we invest in education. We invest in early education. We invest in health care. And so those sorts of things have positive long-term impacts on the well-being of kids. One of the concerns that we have at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families is, are we continuing to invest in kids the way we have in the past? And we're concerned that we're not doing that sufficiently. And so in subsequent years, that we might drop down in the rankings.
So in terms of the gains that have been made in education and health, what are the markers that you're looking at?
Well, we look at things like third grade reading and eighth grade math and high school graduation. And we find in those statistics that we're getting better. But it's also true that we still have some challenges there. So we know, for example, that nearly two-thirds of our third graders aren't reading proficiently at fourth grade. So that's a challenge, even though we're doing better over time and better than the rest in the nation. The other thing that a lot of your listeners who are from the Dane County area will have been hearing about is high school graduation and differential rates by race on high school graduation. So while overall we do really well nationally when it comes to high school graduation, in fact, our white kids here have the highest graduation rate in the nation. It's also true that statewide, African-American kids, only two-thirds of them graduate, and here in Madison, only half of them graduate on time. So there's some real differences within these numbers.
Now, how does that place us among our peers, the rates of African-American graduation?
Well, unfortunately, it places us at the bottom. So there was another report that the Casey Foundation put out a few months ago that looked in a similar way across the nation, but broke it out by race. And unfortunately, the well-being of Wisconsin's African-American kids was ranked dead last in the nation. So of the 46 states that they had enough numbers to rank, we were last. And so usually we look to other places to be last, and we're happy when we do well, but we have to confront that, the fact that we do well on average, but we leave behind big segments of our population.
So that's clearly room for improvement there. Do you have areas that you'd like us to target, initiatives that you think that Wisconsin should be pursuing?
Yes, we think that we should take a two-generation approach. So The solutions that we need have to be broad and comprehensive. They need to focus on kids, particularly investing in the early years where we know that there's a huge return on that investment. People at the Federal Reserve say that that beats the stock market, that 10% return on investment for high quality early care and education. We have to continue to invest in education, but also we need to have more family supporting jobs for parents. So it needs to be two generations, the parents and the kids.
Okay, so there you're getting into the area of poverty. How do Wisconsin kids, how are they affected by poverty here in the state?
Well, there's some good news and bad news when it comes to poverty. The good news is that we're lower than the national average when it comes to children's poverty. The bad news is that we're catching up to that national average very quickly. And also, not surprisingly from what I just said about some of the education challenges, poverty isn't evenly shared across our state. So while the child poverty rate for white kids in our state is 5%, for African-American kids, it's nearly 50%. And so that's another challenge that communities of color face. So we have some work to do when it comes to the poverty measures. And also when you look at concentrated poverty, and so children living in high poverty areas, that's also increasing in our state. So we need to attack that.
So what markers are you looking at when you look at economic well-being?
So we look at the child poverty rate. We look at employment rates. We look at children living in households with a high burden for their housing, and also teens not in school and not working, so sort of disconnected from systems. And so three of those four worsened over the most recent period. The only one that improved slightly was the one around children living in high households with high cost burdens for housing. And just for context, when we're talking about the number of children in poverty, we're talking nearly 250,000 Wisconsin children living in poverty.
What are the long-term challenges? What do you see when kids get their start in life in poverty? What happens to their outcomes later on?
Well, I think one of the things that we find is that the stress level in those households are higher. We can all imagine how that could be when parents are working two jobs, when they don't know if there's going to be enough food on the table. That then translates into educational challenges for kids. Now, it is also true that many kids in impoverished households do really well. And so it's not to say that that can't happen, but the odds are stacked against children when they have the sorts of stresses that living in high poverty households or high poverty neighborhoods creates. And then that has a impact on health. It then affects education, which then affects the next generation of families.
So you mentioned having a greater abundance of jobs that can support families. Are there other things that you're looking at to improve poverty levels?
Well, as I said earlier, the two-generation approach and actually thinking about high-quality early care and education and K-12 and post-secondary education is a really important aspect of poverty reduction. Another thing to think about is not just having more jobs, but having better access to jobs. And so, we hear about how there's sometimes a gap between the skills that employers are looking for and the skills that workers have. And that's an education issue. And so if we want to look towards the future and the next generation, we need to close those education gaps so that employers have the type of employees that they need in the knowledge economy that we're going to see today and in the future.
We're talking right now with Ken Taylor from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about the well-being of children here in the state. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking about the well-being of Wisconsin children. A new report ranks Wisconsin 13th among the states in child well-being and finds that in the last 25 years, our kids have made great strides in the area of health and education, but are much worse off economically.
You can join the conversation with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. Is there something going on in your part of the state that you think is particularly good or bad for kids' well-being in areas like health, education, and the economy? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email talk@WPR.org. We have Ken Taylor with us. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
And Ken, Wisconsin has made steady gains in the area of health. We've talked a bit about that. But can you tell us a little bit about, for instance, how many children are insured, how we've seen that trend move along?
Well, the news on insurance has been quite good. And we have been a top-tier state when it comes to the number of children that we have with health insurance. I would say that having health insurance is an important first step, but just the first step, because then once you have insurance, you need to have actual access to care, and just having insurance doesn't necessarily provide that. And then that care needs to be high-quality care. But that being said, having health insurance is an incredibly important first step, and we have been a top-tier state over the past few years. We've actually been sliding back in the rankings, not because we've been getting worse, but because other states have been getting better. So we're basically holding steady while other states are passing us by and getting more and more of their kids insured.
Now, did the Affordable Care Act come into play in the results this year, or is this something you expect to see more of next year in the results?
Well, it is starting to come to play. So the Affordable Care Act, as many of your listeners will know, is a big health care reform, and different states have made different choices in how they're using the Affordable Care Act in their states. And so our state chose not to use the Affordable Care Act to provide additional coverage for low-income residents. And so the states who have are starting to see their insurance or uninsured rates go down, whereas ours are basically holding steady, which is why folks are passing us by. When it comes to kids, there's been a different dynamic at play here, which is a little more complex when it comes to what's happening with adults.
So you'll probably have a fuller picture of what's happening there next year.
Right. And over time, with the Affordable Care Act and all of the challenges that that's presenting, both legally and all sorts of other ways, the long-term implications will take a little time to shake out, and so that we can have a better picture of what it means over time.
Now, you said Wisconsin is in the top tier. You say at the sort of the lower edge of the top tier. But are there emerging trends here about where children do especially well and where they do less well?
Right. So when you look at the map that the Casey Foundation puts out, we see that there's concentrations within the map of where children generally do better and where the well-being is generally worse. And so we find that the concentrations of places where they generally do better are in the upper Midwest and in the New England states. And then where they generally do worse is in the southern states, from South Carolina across to New Mexico, the whole southern tier of our country.
And why is that? What do you think is going on?
I think it's a complex question, but for me, the simplest answer is that the upper Midwest and New England states invest more in their kids. So when you look at education and health care, for example, the upper Midwest invests more. So, for example, we have some neighbors who are higher ranked than we are. So Iowa this year was ranked number 3, and Minnesota was ranked number 5. And so while I'm proud of our 13th ranking, I would like us to be closer to our neighbors to the west. And when we look at why that might be, you know, one of the things that we look at is education and education spending. And we see that in Wisconsin over the last 5 years, we've had a 15% cut in education. And over the same period, Minnesota has had a slight increase, 0.3%. And Iowa has had over an 11% increase in education spending you know, during this tough economic time. And so that's an example of, you know, there isn't a direct causation.
Mm-hmm. But you put it down to investment in children.
Investment. And I think there's a correlation between the level of investment and how well kids do.
We've got a caller now. Let's go to Bonnie joining us in Rice Lake. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I live in Rice Lake, but I work in a small rural school district that's south of Rice Lake. And I'm wondering if you look at the increase, at least what we're seeing is increase, of homelessness among children.
Okay, good question, Bonnie. How did homeless children factor into this?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have data for homeless children in this particular report, but I would say that it's
they're not included among the poverty numbers.
Well, they're certainly within the poverty mm-hmm. numbers, but we don't have a particular data point about homeless children
versus.
And the increases. But it's very logical and unfortunate that when you see poverty increasing, that you would see homelessness increasing as well. And as you're saying, Bonnie, the educational impacts of homelessness. I was talking earlier about high stress environments and the impacts that has on kids living in impoverished families. Well, homelessness brings that up to a whole nother level. And so, you know, you could probably tell me more about the implications of that, Bonnie, but the difficulty of focusing on your studies when you're not clear where you're going to sleep that night, I think should be apparent to everyone.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Bonnie. And we have an open line if you'd like to call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we want to talk here about a little more on health. One area of concern is the number of low birth weight babies. You've been talking about a lot of areas of improvement, but this is one that has cropped up this time. What are we seeing in terms
right.
of low birth weight babies?
Yeah, so most of the health indicators are staying steady or getting better, and this one is getting worse. It's only slightly worse, but the fact that in the rest of the nation this is getting better, and for us it's getting slightly worse, is troubling. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with the challenges that families face and the stress that they're under and the implications that has for, you know, pregnancy and then the delivery of their children. And so for me that links back to poverty, and that the people that work in the healthcare world would talk about the social determinants of health. And so, you know, it's not just about the quality of the healthcare and your relationship with your doctor. It's all the things that surround that have to do with stress, have to do with how you eat, has to do with how well you're sleeping, and all those sorts of things that impact health, and that all gets passed on to the babies.
So it's a package of factors that are reflected in this one data point.
Right. And so, you know, as I said, the data isn't getting much worse. And so I don't want to draw too big a conclusion from a slight downturn. But the fact is that in the rest of the country, it's getting better. And so that is cause for concern. Right.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get one more call in. Julian joins us right now in Milwaukee. Hi, Julian.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I was just curious, is this just pure averages where we can be dead last for African-Americans in the country and still end up 13th? Is there some other division besides race? Is it the same economic factors between white and blacks in the same classes, or are they still overperforming and blacks underperforming?
That's a great question, Julian. And a lot of it has to do with the relative size of the population. So, you know, in our state, we're roughly 85% white. And so when you look on average of when the well-being of whites all over the country, you know, out is better than communities of color, when the percentages are so low relative to the rest of the country, you know, this is a nation that's getting more and more diverse. And for the first time in 2012, there were fewer white babies born than non-white babies, but in Wisconsin, we're behind that demographic trend. So most of the numbers are based on the averages, and so, you know, we have a relatively small African American population, and so we do quite well on average. But within that African American population, there are big challenges that we need to address.
And we'll leave it there. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Ken Taylor is the executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about how our least favorite things about summer, the poison ivy, the mosquitoes, could get worse because of global warming.
First, a tentative deal was reached today in Congress to reform the Veterans Administration healthcare system. The Department of Veterans Affairs has come under fire in the last few months because of allegations of serious shortcomings at its medical facilities.
Lee Munsell is with us to discuss this deal and how Congress might reform the VA health system. She's a defense reporter for Politico. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we heard today from Bernie Sanders on the Senate side, Jeff Miller on the House side, had a press conference today to unveil this deal. What are the main points of it? What are the broad strokes?
Well, the things we know that are kind of the main points of this bill, it's a $17 billion overall bill. The legislation costs $17 billion overall. It allocates $5 billion of that to hire new doctors and nurses, so it beefs up the staff at the VA. It also gives the VA secretary new authority to fire or demote senior officials accused of mismanagement, so trying to kind of take aim at the sorts of people who were responsible for the mismanagement that brought this to the forefront of the national attention span a couple months ago. It also creates a system where veterans can seek private care if their VA doctors are unable to treat them within 14 days. So again, if you remember, there were these wait line situations where people were waiting for a really long time to even be seen in the first place. So this bill allows veterans to seek care outside of the VA system if it's taking too long to be seen. A couple other things it does, it caps the costs for the veterans seeking private care, so it keeps it at a certain cap. It also removes some of the bureaucratic barriers that slowed hiring and also prohibits bonuses for VA employees through 2016 because the bonuses were another thing that came under fire.
So it sounds like they're trying to tackle two major problems seen at the VA. First, the long wait times for veterans to get into a hospital in the first place, and then the scandal over the cover-ups and accountability and management of the VA. Were those two key parts of a plan here?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are kind of some of the first things they were trying to fix. Obviously, the issues that we've seen have to do with the quality of care as well as the time in which it takes for veterans to receive care at all. So those are some of the things they tried to get to with this bill.
Are you surprised that they're announcing a deal? Because it seemed like just late last week there was some finger-pointing going on about the lack of a deal and whose fault it was, and then they got through the weekend. They've got something today.
Yeah, last week this bill looked to be in very dire straits. One of the things that kind of sinks bills in Congress in general is how long it takes to come to a deal. And in this case, they're heading out on August recess at the end of this week. So even though this bill has been announced, a deal has been come to by the leaders in the House and the Senate on the VA committees, they still have to get it passed through both the House and the Senate and to the president's desk by Friday if they want to do this before recess. So there are kind of some time issues as well.
Have we heard anything from veterans groups responding to this yet?
You know, they're just now, I mean, this deal was just made today. The things that I've seen are just the applauding of a deal at all. The fact that it did happen because, again, it didn't look like it was going to last week. But that's really kind of the first. It seems like people are kind of parsing the language for more specific responses, and those will start to roll in now in the next couple of hours, I'd imagine.
Maybe a similar answer here. Are we hearing any criticism of this from Congress, any indication that a lot of representatives might be voting against this?
Not necessarily. I mean, I haven't heard anything about vote tallies yet or what it looks like specifically trying to get this through the House or the Senate. They're certainly in the Senate. There are procedural hurdles that will make it more difficult as far as getting this done on time. But as far as, like, a strong opposition bloc, that's less likely. This is the sort of, you know, if the fact that the leaders of these committees can come up with a compromise, a lot of times it's the sort of bipartisan thing that should pass fairly well in Congress. In fact, these sorts of veterans bills are the sorts of things that people can get behind pretty easily, but that's not to say that this is done by any means.
I was going to say there's a lot of legislation that's going to be left on the table by the end of this week, immigration and some other things. When it comes to a veterans issue, especially one that's been in the news so much, do you think that there's a lot of heat on Congress to get something done?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a big part of why we saw this deal kind of break through over the weekend and then was finally announced today. There's a lot of pressure to get something done on this VA issue. There have been a lot of hearings over the past couple of months with different VA officials. Sloan Gibson, the interim VA head, was just on Capitol Hill last week taking a grilling from lawmakers about what sorts of things can be done and should be done to improve the VA. So, there's a lot of push to try and get this legislation done before the Congress leaves for recess.
What were some of the sticking points last week? I know one of the issues was where the money, however much money it was going to come from.
Yeah, well, that was what the stalemate kind of came from, was the funding and deciding where it would come from at all. So it's not necessarily the policy differences, but it was about how to pay for it. So there are a lot of different things that people suggested, but it was just really some people had different ideas than others on how to come up with the $17 billion, which it ended up being for this bill.
One of the concerns I know was that if, as the plan does, you let veterans go outside the VA system when they couldn't get timely care, there's a concern that there'd be a stampede, a rush away from veterans facilities and into private systems. What, in the agreement reached today, did they address that concern?
Yes, well, this bill today does, it creates a system where veterans can seek private care if VA doctors aren't able to treat them within 14 days. So it's more of a kind of if-then proposition. It's not that everyone can do this in every case if they would prefer to go outside the VA system. It just makes that option available to certain veterans who need it, which it seems to be a compromise of sorts.
So plan A, if you're a veteran, is still you have to start at the VA, and only then if you can't get care in that time period or within a certain distance, as I understand it, then that billions of dollars to help fund outside treatment, that's when that kicks in.
Yeah, according to, you know, what I've seen so far and a quick reading of the bill, that's what it seems like is the case, that you originally have to start within the VA system, and then if it takes more than 14 days to be seen, then you can go elsewhere.
There's been obviously a lot of criticism of the VA healthcare system in recent months. Is this a little tweak around the edge, or do you think this really tackles head on the real issues and the image problems that came out of all this?
Well, it's a start. I mean, certainly we know that the VA has a lot more going on. It's almost like the metaphor of an iceberg that you only see just the tip top of it, and there's a lot more going on in this really massive organization that's had a number of issues for years, which we've known about some of them, and some of them we're just finding out about now. So there's still a lot to be done within the VA, certainly, but this is a start.
We'll leave it there for now. Lee, thanks for checking in with us today.
Thank you.
That's Lee Munsell. She's defense reporter at Politico. Summer is a season a lot of us look forward to, but it comes with its downfalls. According to a new report from the Natural Resources Defense Council, global warming will make some of the most common summer complaints even worse.
Brian Clark Howard joins us now. He's an editor and producer for NationalGeographic.com. His piece, Eight Summer Miseries Made Worse by Global Warming from Poison Ivy to Allergies, can be found on the National Geographic website and on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when we talk about climate change, global warming, the first thing we want to know is how hot is it going to get in summer? What can you tell us about that big question?
Well, Veronica, it's scientists say that summers are going to get hotter and drier over the next 100 years. the temperatures could rise anywhere from about 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit all the way up to 11 degrees Fahrenheit on average. That's over the next 100 years. So we're definitely looking at hotter summers.
So when you're talking about, say, let's say in Wisconsin here, an 81-degree day, when you talk instead about, you know, something that's verging on 90, that seems to feel quite a bit different to us here. This is something we're going to notice.
Oh, absolutely. Even at the low end of that, Veronica, when I said 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit, that might not sound like a lot, but that's enough to make the difference between what today is in Wisconsin to what's in parts of Texas today. Because over the course of the year, a few degrees makes a big difference in averages.
How confident are scientists in that model?
Very confident. That is why there's a range. We don't know. Also, we don't know exactly what's going to be done in terms of reducing greenhouse gases. Scientists are more than 99% confident, though, that human activities are increasing the temperatures globally. And this is something that is over the course of, say, 100 years. That's why that's a good time to look at. We can't say with a lot of confidence what's going to happen 2 years from now necessarily, but we know the long-term trends very well with a high degree of confidence.
And another the things in summertime that, at least here in Wisconsin, we're not so jazzed about, mosquitoes. Mosquito season is never anyone's favorite, even though we love summer. What can we expect in terms of biting insects?
Well, unfortunately, biting insects can be a real problem. Not only are they pesky, but they can also spread a lot of serious diseases like West Nile, dengue fever. And scientists are telling us that they're going to spread further. Mosquitoes are now being found in more areas. They're pushing farther north. In fact, in 2012, Maine recorded its first ever human case of West Nile virus, and that's been attributed to the spread of mosquitoes. They like warmer weather. They also like more moisture. As certain parts of the country are getting drier, other parts are getting wetter, and mosquitoes can take advantage of that.
So are mosquitoes the primary insect we're talking about here, or are there other things we should be thinking about?
Well, ticks, most famous for carrying Lyme disease, are also spreading. There's also winter ticks, which previously had been killed off during the coldest times. They're now surviving a lot more, and so people are seeing ticks through much more parts of the year, so that gives more chance for disease.
Winter ticks. Okay, that's definitely bad news here. Well, we're talking about that, and also breathing. Just the quality of the air is something, I gather, that can be affected. What sorts of changes are we seeing forecasted?
Well, absolutely. The warmer air tends to hold more pollution, and there tends to be more smog on hotter days. And in fact, summer typically has the worst air quality over any period. And so what we're going to see are more smog-filled days, more air pollution. And not only is that an inconvenience, but it can be directly injurious to people's health. 27 million Americans now suffer from asthma, and asthma can be directly exacerbated by poor air quality.
So we're talking smog. What about things that are in the environment, like ragweed, pollen, that kind of thing?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned ragweed. A recent study found that ragweed actually is producing pollen for an additional month longer than it did just a few years ago because of global warming. So what we're expecting is that a lot more people, and right now it's 30 to 40 million Americans, have seasonal allergies. That's likely to go up over the next few decades because when it's warmer, plants have more time to grow, and also with more carbon dioxide directly in the air, plants use that and they grow faster. They grow bigger faster, so that means they can release more pollen.
So longer growing seasons and bigger plants just releasing more allergens is what you're describing.
Yes, exactly. And unfortunately, some people have said, well, you know, maybe it'll even out because our crop plants will grow bigger and faster. And that's what we're finding actually is that studies show the nutritional value of crop plants actually is going down with more carbon dioxide. So it's not like we're kind of getting the worst of both worlds in that sense.
And let's look at another aspect here now. As long as we're talking about plants, what about poison ivy, poison oak?
Well, poison ivy is one of those plants that definitely grows faster. And not only that, but some studies suggest it grows more toxic. The chemical in poison ivy and also in poison oak gets more toxic, and that is going to cause more reactions.
So why would it get more toxic? Because it's warmer.
It has to do with the chemistry of the plant. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but some studies have suggested that it's the urushiol, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, the chemical that's in poison ivy and poison oak that makes people have the reaction, that actually gets stronger according to some experiments, when there's more carbon dioxide. Hmm.
So we could have poison ivy on steroids.
Yes, and they're also worried that the ranges will expand. Right now, there's no poison ivy in Alaska, Hawaii, or California. There is poison oak in California, but there's some worry that it could arrive there or at least expand the places where it grows in other states.
In terms of swimming, you know, that's, again, a big plus generally in summertime. Do we need to be concerned about, you know, the water that we're going to be in?
Yes. Well, as plants on the land can grow quicker, bigger, with more heat and especially more carbon dioxide, that's the same in the water. So in the water, of course, the plants are called algae. And so with more algae blooms, when you get too much of that, it can release toxins, and it can also use up too much oxygen, and that causes fish and other things to die, and that can release nasty stuff too. So either you're going to have less pleasant experiences because the beach might smell, or it might look kind of gross, you might have a lot of dead fish, or there might be releases directly of toxins that can either give you skin reactions, sort of like allergies, or in more serious cases can even lead to illness. Especially if you're consuming seafood that comes from areas where they have an algal bloom, it could even be life-threatening.
Now, this is pretty grim stuff we're talking about. How soon can we expect to see some of these things become a reality, according to this report?
The report is looking at both 100 years and then also at mid-century, seeing a lot of significant things happening, although they noticed that there's definitely evidence that things have already been happening. They point to eight of the nine hottest years on record since record keeping began have been just over the past few years. So a lot of things are changing now. There's a lot of places, especially, that are seeing rising seas. Algae blooms have been a big issue already this summer. There's a lot of things that are happening already and that will continue to happen just over the next few years. You won't see a huge increase in poison ivy tomorrow, say, but in the next few years it should start to be quite noticeable.
So if we're just looking at the continental United States, say, how does Wisconsin factor in, and how does the rest of the country, how will they be impacted?
Well, another report that came out this year said that the upper Midwest is actually highly susceptible to heat waves, and that some of the biggest increase in temperatures is likely to be in the Wisconsin and other parts of the upper Midwest. It has to do with the sort of macro scale weather trends and where things are now versus where they're going. So there's going to be some significant changes there. And some people have said it'll be good in the short term for maybe having a few more growing days for crops there. But at the same time, you're also going to have more heat waves that could be dangerous. You're going to have other invasive species, in addition to poison ivy, which is native, but also invasive species coming in. So there's going to be a lot of disruption.
So it sounds like we here in the upper Midwest are on the front line.
Yes, in a lot of ways, certainly when it comes to heat waves. And I think, too, a lot of species that are coming, a lot of the invasives that are coming in.
Well, there's still a couple other things that you wrote about that I want to get to. And one of these is the effect on food and foodborne illness. What can you tell us about that?
Well, a lot of things grow bigger, faster, as we discussed, with heat, and food pathogens, especially bacteria, could be in that category as well, especially when it comes to Salmonella and Campylobacter, which are the two of the biggest foodborne illness causers. Already, summers show the highest number of cases of illness based on those two pathogens, and just sort of looking into the future, as summers get longer and hotter, we're going to be seeing more illnesses with those things. It's also sort of like, think of it as a buffet that is not set up properly and the food gets too warm. Mm. That's a breeding ground for these nasty pathogens. Well, when the whole world becomes more like a warm buffet, that's going to be more of a problem.
And that will require some adjustment in food safety as we go along, it sounds like. So a last thing that you cover here is national parks, because that's something people like to do, hop in the car and hit a national park. But you're saying there's some bummer news there, too. What are we expecting?
There is. And in fact, I've talked to a number of people who have told me they moved Glacier National Park on their bucket list sooner because they're afraid that within the next few years, certainly within our lifetimes, it's expected that most or all of the glaciers there will be melted. So that'll be a radically different visitor experience in that park, and that's the same for other parks that have ice features. But also for beaches, we just on NationalGeographic.com, we just did a big series about the Outer Banks in North Carolina, another popular vacation spot. We're already seeing rising seas and advanced erosion, and there's already people are losing their homes. There's infrastructure that's damaged. There's roads that are getting washed out. So it's going to be harder to visit there. So a lot of places are already seeing impacts. You have a lot of impacts, too, with invasive species that are able to come in, species compositions changing. Luckily, we're finding a study came out recently that said wild species are a little bit more adaptable to global warming than what scientists had previously thought. So it might not be all catastrophic. There's definitely going to be changes. It's going to be the parks are going to be different parks than the parks that our grandparents visited. So there's going to be some bad, as you suggest, but possibly some good as well. But it's certainly going to be different.
Well, Brian, it's not good news, but thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Brian Clark Howard, editor and producer for NationalGeographic.com. His piece, Eight Summer Miseries Made Worse by Global Warming, from Poison Ivy to Allergies, can be found on the National Geographic website and on the Central Time Facebook page.